From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A panel discussion about free speech and Palestinian rights at the University of Massachusetts, taking place May 4th, has become yet another flashpoint in the fight to speak out freely on a contentious topic. Well-known commentators like Linda Sarsour, Mark Lamont Hill, and Vijay Prashad were being advertised as speakers for the event, which is called Not Backing Down, Israel, Free Speech, and the Battle for Palestinian Rights. Well, a panel on the backlash against pro-Palestinian voices itself ironically faced a backlash with a legal request to stop the panel from taking place. But a judge has just ruled that the First Amendment does not have an exception when it comes to discussing Palestinian rights. The lawsuit attempting to stop the panel is one of many such attempts to squash any and all discussion of Palestinian rights around the U.S. We go now to Massachusetts to speak with Rachel Weber, who is an attorney based there, and Joseph Levine, a professor and chair of philosophy at UMass Amherst. Both of them are also members of Western Mass Jewish Voice for Peace. Welcome to the program, Rachel and Joseph.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So first, tell us a little bit about who launched the lawsuit and what their basis for this is.
Sure. The lawsuit was launched on behalf of three unnamed anonymous UMass students. The filings indicated that they were Jewish students who were concerned that if the event went forward on UMass's campus, that it would amount to a violation of UMass's discrimination policy, because in discussing Palestinian human rights, that would amount to anti-Semitism. So those are the group launching the lawsuit.
So you didn't even know who was launching it. And so in defending yourself against this suit, tell us what happened and what the judge's decision was.
Certainly. So initially, the only defendants that were named in the suit was a number of people on the Board of Trustees and in the administration of UMass. JVP is one of the co-sponsors of the event, and we really wanted to intervene in the lawsuit to make sure that our concerns were made known to the judge. And so we filed a motion to intervene and ended up in communication with the panelists and the event organizers, ended up filing a motion to intervene on behalf of Jewish Voice for Peace, Students for Justice in Palestine, Sut Jali, who is the organizer of the event, and his organization, the Media Education Foundation, as well as Linda Sarsour, Roger Waters, Mark Lamont Hill, and Dave Zirin, who are the panelists, as well as the moderator, Vijay Prashad. So we filed a motion to intervene to address our concerns with the filings, which really amounted to a smear campaign against the panelists, as well as a deep mischaracterization of what the event was all about and what its impact would be on campus.
Speaking of a smearing of the panelists, Vijay Prashad on his Facebook page posted a poster that had been making the rounds of social media directly targeting the event and the panelists, filled with lies. The poster is entitled Meet the Anti-Semites, speaking at UMass on May 4th, and it has all of the panelists and the moderator listed. For example, Vijay Prashad is being accused of conspiracizing that Hitler and Zionists planned the Holocaust together, and other such, pretty false smears, especially for anybody who's followed the work of people like Vijay Prashad, Linda Sarsour, and others. Joseph Levine, what do you make of this really strong propaganda campaign?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not surprised. I mean, this kind of rhetoric, I have been working on behalf of Palestinian rights off and on in various groups since the early 1980s. And this kind of vilification of Palestinian solidarity activists as being terrorists, as supporting, blowing up women and children, being neo-Nazis, this is just the rhetoric that has been going on for decades. What's significant now is that finally people are pushing back and they're saying, you know what, we're not going to put up with this kind of nonsense. You either argue with us with respect and civility and actually respond to what we're saying and not to some fantasy you have about who we are, or we're going to ignore you, because we're not going to respond to these kinds of things. They're just I mean, they're as nonsensical as anything you could imagine on the alt-right or in the minds of any of the extreme white supremacist groups.
Now, you bring up the alt-right, and in fact, of course, the figures among the alt-right, such as white supremacists like Richard Spencer or the provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos, have claimed some of the same things that pro-Palestinian groups have been claiming, which is they have the First Amendment right to speak out on campuses. And unfortunately, pro-Palestinian voices have been equated with some of these dangerous white supremacist groups. What do you make of that?
Well, that's the tactic. The idea, in fact, it's not, they would have loved to have stopped this. Of course, they would have loved to have won the injunction, but they probably didn't expect to. What they want to do, and this is why we intervened, is they want to put us in the same box as these other hate groups. Now, hate groups have First Amendment rights too. And there are, of course, issues that cover Milo Yiannopoulos and Richard Spencer because they have free speech rights, and we have to respect those. But if you can characterize the Palestine Solidarity activists as being in that group and then only defend them on this narrow First Amendment grounds, you've won the battle, because then you have framed us as being part of the margins and filled with hate. Of course, that's nonsense. If anything, many of the right-wing Zionists are much closer to those groups and for those and those sentiments. When you see some of the right-wing Zionist rhetoric about Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims, you realize, oh yes, yeah, they do have a home, and that home is on the far right. And it's not a coincidence that today some of Israel's best friends in the world are far-right governments, like the sort of fascist governments in Hungary and in Austria and in the Gulf states, because there is a certain sense of racial ethnic supremacy and authoritarianism that they all share. And the thing is that we in this movement, the Linda Sarsours and Roger Waters and all those people, we're on the side of human rights, humanism, the idea that everybody is equal. And we oppose Zionism because we oppose the idea of an ethnically established state. We want a state for all its citizens. How could that possibly be counted as anti-Semitic?
And Rachel, as an attorney, isn't there a difference between speaking about a certain issue and inciting violence? Some of the white supremacist speakers, for example, Milo Yiannopoulos had threatened to out undocumented students at campuses he was to speak at. And so there is a very clear difference, right? You don't have a First Amendment protection for speech that could literally jeopardize the safety of individuals, which I don't think pro-Palestinian groups have ever done that.
Right. And so that's actually what the judge's ruling was based on. The judge said that the plaintiffs in this case had not shown a shred of evidence that there was any kind of risk of actual harm that would be coming to any of these students on campus. And the issue is all about how you define things. If you define violence as criticizing Israel, if you define anti-Semitism as standing up for Palestinian human rights, then you can make all of the arguments you want, but they're based on faulty premises. And this was part of our argument to the judge, that aside from the First Amendment analysis, which might say, look, even despicable viewpoints, deserve to be heard, that was not our stance in court. Our stance was, these viewpoints are not despicable, they are not anti-Semitic, these are human rights advocates who deserve to be heard on a university campus. A university is supposed to be a place of learning, a vibrant intellectual community, and this in particular was a panel about the censorship and repression that is faced by people who are outspoken about advocating for Palestinian rights. Just like the lawsuit is exactly an example of why this panel needs to take place. And so, it really ended up being, the parties arguing about definitions, because, if you say, anything critical of Israel is violence against Israel and therefore violence against Jews, and those are huge jumps in logic you have to make that many, many Jews in this country and across the world would disagree with, then, you know, then you can say whatever you want to say about the panelists who may advocate for Palestinian human rights.
And now, unfortunately, it's not just those on the right who conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. For example, just about less than a week ago, the New York Times published a cartoon which many denounced as anti-Semitic. It basically showed Benjamin Netanyahu on a leash being pulled by Donald Trump as a blind man. And in his criticism of the cartoon in the New York Times, opinion columnist Brett Stevens, the op-ed was entitled "A Despicable Cartoon in the Times." And what he wrote was that anti-Zionism is all but indistinguishable from anti-Semitism in practice and often in intent, however much progressives try to deny this. Joseph, what do you make of this equivalence between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism in the New York Times?
Well, that Brett Stevens does, he does it often, by the way. I've read many of his columns with that. Look, it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. But it's based on the following idea, which I think often is not actually articulated. So what the other side will tell you in trying to equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism is they'll say, you see, Zionism is the movement for the national self-determination of the Jewish people. So if you oppose Zionism, you are opposing the right for Jews to have self-determination. And therefore, that's a kind of anti-Semitism. That is their basic argument. If you go back to all the definitions of anti-Semitism that they look at, coming from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, taken up by the State Department, taken up, you know, by the UC Regents recently, I think. I mean, this is all what it's based on. And the problem is, it's a fallacy. It's a complete and utter fallacy. Jews have a right of self-determination in the sense that we have the right to be full citizens in any nation that we live in. Yes, that we have. But no people, it's not just Jews, no people ethnically defined have the right to set up a state in and sovereignty in an area and claim this state belongs to us and minorities can just be tolerated. That is not a democratic idea. So Zionism is opposed to some of the most fundamental principles of democracy. And it's interestingly, and if you go back to the early movement of Zionism, the late 19th, early 20th century, many, many Jewish leaders, I mean, really well-respected leaders, the heads of the Jewish community in Great Britain and others, objected to political Zionism. This is the Zionism we're talking about, the idea that there can be a Jewish state that is for the Jews. They objected largely on the grounds, interestingly, that this was a dangerous doctrine because it kind of racializes Jews. It makes them into a people apart from other people. And people had been working since the beginning of the Enlightenment in the movement to emancipate Jews from the ghettos to say, no, we're not a separate race. It's a religion. It's a community, but we can be just as good English citizens and French citizens and German citizens as anybody else. So in opposition to what was then thought of as the progressive way of emancipating Jews from all the restrictions they had in medieval and Renaissance Europe, these people are coming along and saying, no, we are a nation apart and we don't belong in your countries and we have to go and take over this other one. Well, many Jews found that extremely dangerous and anti-democratic, and they were opposed.
And it's exactly this kind of discussion that you have laid out and these ideas that you have laid out that, of course, it seems as though the pro-Israel, the pro-right-wing Israel forces want to prevent from taking place. What about the victories that some are now enjoying to preserve the right to have such discussions? In Texas, there was a judge that ruled recently that a woman who was fired because she refused to sign essentially a loyalty oath on Israel had her First Amendment rights violated. It was basically part of Texas's law to try to stop the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement. Do you see that as a victory, Rachel?
we're seeing a lot of new tactics that are being used by people who want to criminalize and delegitimize the BDS movement, and in doing so, the call for Palestinian civil society for international help to their predicament. And in response to those new tactics, there's always new resistance. And so for every legal attack that we're seeing crop up, there's an organized, powerful, intersectional resistance to those efforts, because people can see a number of different connections here, where it's a slippery slope. Once you start saying that particular speech is not okay because of the differences of certain opinions about definitions, well, what's next? And then also a recognition that the struggle for Palestinian human rights isn't occurring in isolation. It's connected to struggles for self-determination and dignity and peace that are shared by communities around the world, including in this country. There's been an amazing confluence between the Black Lives Matter movement and the movements for Palestinian human rights. And so people see these efforts for what they are and continue to be creative and resilient and determined in resisting them.
And of course, there is a real reason to fear a return of anti-Semitism today in the United States, right? We had 6 months ago the synagogue massacre in Pittsburgh, and an attempted massacre that resulted in one death in Southern California here near San Diego, where we're based in Southern California, the Poway Synagogue. And those sorts of attacks, some on the right, such as Senator Ted Cruz and Meghan McCain, were attempting to connect to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's criticism of the state of Israel and saying that it's people like her who have been encouraging anti-Semitism. What do you make of that, Joseph?
Well, first of all, the people that are carrying out those attacks, they hate Ilhan Omar just as much as they hate us.
I mean, right. The guy was the suspect in the synagogue shooting has been charged with setting fire to a mosque in Escondido, right?
And I think he said he was inspired by the New Zealand massacre. Mm-hmm. This is what we were talking about earlier. There is this constant attempt to put us in a box. It's really interesting. I mean, you know, there are real issues about the rhetoric that's coming out of the Trump administration, you know, the fine people on both sides of Charlottesville and all that, where I think it's legitimate to say that he is opening up space for people to take it to the next level and actually incite attacks on Muslims, immigrants, and Jews. But the political establishment, especially the Republican Party, and I have to say some members of the Democratic Party, are refusing to draw those connections and instead are drawing the connection between the movement for Palestinian human rights and these anti-Semitic attacks. But there's no actual history of any kind of interaction between these sorts of groups. They are really, in fact, antithetically opposed to each other. The Palestinian rights activists are human rights activists. They care about the fact that, I mean, look, in 2014, Israel went into Gaza and massacred 2,500 people, 500 children. That's what is moving us. Right. And all of this other stuff is nonsense. And they're just trying to hide because they don't actually have any arguments. All they have is smearing.
So then do you feel that any of these attempts have had a chilling effect on speech? I mean, especially on campuses where there has been a flowering of groups, emboldened to speak out about Palestinian rights, including many young American Jews. Have these recent efforts to criminalize speech about Palestinian rights had any kind of a chilling effect, as far as you can tell, on the work that groups like Students for Justice in Palestine do?
Well, I think that, you know, I certainly think that it's true that they are, the intimidation that groups like Students for Justice in Palestine is receiving is real. And the various attacks on other supporters of Palestine on campuses and elsewhere is very real.
And we have the example of Mark Lamont Hill, right? One of the panelists at the May 4th event, who lost his position at CNN because of his criticism of the state of Israel.
Exactly. So there are real consequences that people are facing, and yet they still speak because they're moved. And the Students for Justice in Palestine still organize because they're moved to. And Mark Lamont Hill is coming to this panel to speak because he's moved to. So while the efforts at repression are incredibly dangerous and incredibly real, people are resisting against it and still being guided by their conscience and doing what they can to advocate for Palestinian human rights.
Well, you know, they are having a backlash because they're actually pissing people off. It's getting to the point where people are saying, "Oh, come on, we're just not going to stand for this anymore." So in that sense, I think we've seen a sea change, maybe in the last 5-6 years.
And so finally, do you hope that the panel that is actually trying to discuss this very issue of how these voices are being, you know, attempted to be silenced, is that panel discussion going to be made available for the general public? Because, of course, we do need such discussions. I understand that the Media Education Foundation is hopefully going to be taping it.
That's my understanding, is that it won't be live streamed, but that it will be taped and available for public consumption.
And so, of course, getting that out to a wider audience will exactly, serve the purpose, I hope, that the panelists have been trying to serve.
Yes, definitely.
Exactly.
Where can people find out more about the work that Jewish Voice for Peace does?
Well, Jewish Voice for Peace National has a website, jewishvoiceforpeace.org. And from that website, you can click on a map and find out the chapter that's closest to you if you're interested in engaging in that work. There's also many different chapters have Facebook pages, including Jewish Voice for Peace Western Mass. And it's just JVPWMASS. If you search that on Facebook, you'll find us.
And we'll link to that from our website later today. I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Take care.
My guests have been Rachel Weber. She's an attorney based in Massachusetts, and Joseph Levine, professor and chair of philosophy at UMass Amherst, both of them also members of Western Mass Jewish Voice for Peace. We've been discussing ongoing efforts to stop discussions of Palestinian rights. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.